The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hey, listener, are you happy with your current chicken wings? Do you wish you had something a little saucier? If you answered yes, then it might be time for you to break up with your old chicken wings and get a new honey. Lemon pepper wing from Popeyes. Share the wings with your friends so they can see it's time to move on, too. Head to Popeyes and get 6-piece honey lemon pepper wings for $5.99. At participating U.S. restaurants, price may vary.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Today's episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra. Are you happy because you win? Or do you win because you're happy? At only 2.6 carbs and 95 calories, it's only worth it if you enjoy it. Stay tuned for the Ultra Player of the Week coming up later in the episode. Before we get started, today's episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra. Are you happy because you win, or do you win because you're happy? At only 2.6 carbs and 95 calories, it's only worth it if you enjoy it. Stay tuned for the Ultra Player of the Week. John is foaming at the mouth to assign the Ultra Player of the Week to this player. That is coming up later on. Unfortunately, the Atlanta Hawks, Lloyd Pierce, will no longer be around to coach potential Ultra Players of the Week because he has been fired by the Atlanta Hawks. And so I'll open up the floor here to you. I know you wrote about this. You're pretty plugged in with the Hawks being down there. Why did this happen, and should it have happened?
It happened for a multitude of reasons. I think expectations were high, perhaps unreasonably so, coming into this season. Second, I think the doubts about him were already there, so that when they got off to this start, it just compounded what they were already feeling a little bit. And one of the things I wrote about was, usually when you see a coach fired in the middle of the season like this or early in the season, it's a sign that they really should have done it in the off season and were probably thinking about it a little bit. And in situations like that, they should just get on with it, because you end up losing a half season, or basically a full season, because you're going through the rest of the season with a coach you didn't necessarily want either. You know, like if they had gone through a whole search process, would they have ended up with Nate McMillan as the head coach? Maybe, but unlikely, right? So he'll be the interim coach the rest of the year. We'll see what he can get out of this team. There definitely seemed to be some like weirdness around Trae Young in particular, and this is something that's followed him since Oklahoma, though, that he's maybe not the league's most popular teammate. And so I think this is a situation now where the light starts shining on him a little more harshly, too, depending on what happens in Atlanta the rest of this year and in coming seasons.
What did you think of the Athletic's postmortem piece? Obviously, you worked there, but some of the reporting that was in there from Chris Kirshner and Sam Amick talking about how multiple players had discussed with management that they would prefer that they move on from Pierce, and obviously that he didn't connect with Trey. That was no secret by the end, and also that Tony Ressler seemed to be growing more and more frustrated with some of these close losses, and there was a bunch of other stuff in there as well. But what did you make of all that reporting, and you know, how it relates to the idea of whether this is a move that they should have made, or whether Pierce deserved his fate, at least in a basketball sense? Obviously,
the thing about players going to management is tricky, because you want to respect that coming from your players. At the same time, there's some level of self-interest in that, depending on who it's coming from. I mean, honestly, if players went to management, I mean, who would that be, right? I don't think it was Brandon Goodwin and Bruno Fernando, right? Like, you know, it's gonna be the high level guys there, right? So, you know, I don't think you need to draw a map. So
yeah, or maybe it's someone like Rondo or something too.
Yeah, right. Yeah, a veteran with like some status in the league, even though if he's not like their best player right now necessarily. So I think that's a piece of it. I just think the undercurrent to me is that those doubts were already there. So it was pretty easy to chip away at the edifice from that point. Whereas I think, you know, if one of Miami's guys came to Pat Riley complaining about Spoelstra, he'd just be like, get the hell out of my office, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, that seems reasonable. But obviously Pierce did not have that level of resume in 2.5 season. It's, you know, I sympathize with those and who are would defend Pierce's record as an actual court or coach on the floor. I struggle to see the things that, you know, he supposedly should have been better. They did have some late game collapses. I think you can point to a few of those. And there were some things.
The Cleveland game to me was the trigger point.
Yeah.
Losing a game they shouldn't have lost in a way that was kind of tragic. And, you know, you go through, most teams are going to have one game like that a year, you know, but I just think the timing of that was hugely unfortunate for his continued employment prospects.
Yeah, going way too early and then just giving up a game-winning dunk and having no timeouts left with 3 seconds left to advance the ball and try to get a shot. No, that was obviously very ugly.
And having subbed out Capella right before that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess they were worried about him getting fouled, but
yeah.
Which, you know, somewhat reasonable, but you're also, when you're ahead, I think you need to worry more about playing defense in that situation. And then they had another collapse late against Miami. They give up a 10-0 run, and certainly they had vastly underperformed their point differential this year. And as we know, over time, that's luck, but generally that's going to even out. But in the moment, certainly you could point to, hey, this team is having some late game collapses. So that, I mean, you understand all the narrative reasons why this happened. But I mean, if you consider that basically this team that was out on the floor was the same team that went 20-47, Wrestler was like, hey, we need to show like some real progress. They did show some progress. They're
This year's team was last year's team plus Capella. When you factor in that Bogdanović, Gallinari, and Okongwu and Chris Dunn have basically either hardly played or not played well, and certainly I'd add Rondo to that too. And so, and the one guy from last year who had really stepped up, DeAndre Hunter, is now out. They're 5-11 since Hunter went out.
Well, and I think they also, Lloyd Pierce, like the guys they drafted, developed pretty well on this team, right? I mean, Herter maybe a little bit hasn't, but Young got way better. I thought Pierce used Young really well, despite the fact that Young didn't really care for him.
Collins definitely got better.
Yeah, Collins got better. Hunter, DeAndre Hunter was awesome.
Hunter was going to win the most improved player award, I think, if he had stayed on the court. Yeah.
Well, it usually ends up being someone who like ascends to all-star level, but I guess there's nobody really who's done
Julius Randle
that much of that this year. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Randle's going to win it. You're right. He will win it this year if he keeps this up. And even like Capella is having probably the best season of his career, at least the best he's played since the 2018 playoffs in the first couple of rounds. So all that, you know, they had a like -6 net rating with Trae Young on the floor last year, and they're +3 this year. Obviously, it was just the signings that absolutely killed them, and Rondo not being healthy and not being good in the regular season, and Gallo is looking pretty calcified, and he's missed a bunch of time as well. And they've got, you know, Solomon Hill and Tony Snell, and, you know, Cam Reddish has missed a bunch of time as well here. Okongwu was injured. He hasn't really been able to play. Obviously, the loss of Bogdanović was massive, clearly, for their second year. He's only played 229 minutes. So, I mean, if you told me all the injuries they would have before the season and they would have a neutral point differential, even with that, I would have been ecstatic. I thought they'd be a 500 team with everyone healthy.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So on some level, they've overachieved in some ways, right? You could argue. The other thing on the negative side, I mean, the defense has gotten a little better. I mean, they were 25th at the time of the coaching change, which I think they were hoping for a bigger uptick than that.
Yeah, maybe so. But with Clint Capella on the floor, 106.5, with him off the court, 116.4, and they don't really have anyone at backup center who's been any good, or been able to play. So, like, when they've had decent defensive players out there, they've been solid. You know, I think they've really taken a step forward defensively. That's why they got Clint Capella. They've used him really well as a rim protector. But this, of course, gets to my favorite phrase in NBA coaching circles. Clint Eastwood in Unforgiven. happen. And I forget who it was in The Wire. I will look that up the next time you talk. Who said it also. Deserve ain't got nothing to do with it. And that's ultimately what it comes down to. Like this was something that once the players are going to management, the good players are going to management, and Wrestler also seemed pretty fired up about getting better this year. And also the pressure that was on Travis Schlenk. I mean, this was just going to happen.
Everyone saw this coming before the season started, right? If the Hawks didn't start gangbusters, that this was going to happen.
Yeah. And there are the piece from Kirshner and Amick goes into why they didn't do it in the offseason. I mean, there was the pandemic, and then they didn't know whether there's that long 4-month hiatus. They didn't know whether they're going to be invited back to the bubble or not. So you probably didn't want to move on from then. And then obviously he got a ton of positive press, and deservedly so, for his efforts for voting and racial justice, which hopefully he'll be able to continue to do. So I think it was understandable why they didn't move on from him. And also I think like Schlenk really liked him. Like I don't think this was a Travis Schlenk call. I kind of get that feeling. You agree?
How can I put this? I don't think he was dragged into this kicking and screaming.
Okay. All right. I would know more than I do.
I'm not sure. Maybe he wasn't on board with pulling the trigger right now, but that would be closer to my take on it.
Yeah. Well, and also like he didn't get a contract extension. His contract was going to be up. They had a team option for next year. So they didn't. I mean, I guess if your players are kind of iffy on the guy, and then you also don't commit to him and basically say, hey, this is the guy, you guys are going to have to live with it, then I think that's where you're setting him up to not succeed, right? If it's a situation where the players like him, you know, like a Mike D'Antoni last year in Houston where they didn't extend him, then, like, you know, I think it's fine. But if you're going to go with a guy that the players, where the players feel like, oh, it would actually be realistic to get this guy fired if we complain, then they're probably going to complain.
Yeah. you bringing up the contract situation is interesting too, though. I mean, obviously there's a, you know, I think that's the main reason Luke Walton is still coaching right now and Lloyd Pierce isn't.
Yeah, we'll see what happens with him. You know, maybe also the fact that McMillan went 2-1 when Lloyd, I mean, again, like Lloyd is, I definitely understand the angst because, you know, he's a great guy and it seems like he's really getting screwed here, that he leaves the team for 3 games for the birth of his child, and that might be a slight part of why they moved on from him, because McMillan actually did well at 2-1 in that time period.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tough business that way. I had a thought and I lost it.
Well, here's what I can also say. I mean, I do think, however, and I've said this before in the coaching firing rank or situation, that there is just like this really weird belly aching that every coach who gets fired is a tragedy, and Rick Carlisle and Greg Popovich got away.
Oh my God. So just once, can we get a coach from another team to say, you know what? I didn't think he was that good. Like they probably should have fired him. Like, well, can that happen just one time?
Well, and guess what? Like, he's still getting paid, right? Like, this isn't like he's going to starve tomorrow. Like, they're still going to pay out his contract. It's not like, where is all the crying for guys who get cut on non-guaranteed contracts, or the guy who comes in on a 10-day and plays 1 minute and never even gets a chance, and then they move on from him after that? Like, they didn't even have a practice during that time. Like, what? Yeah. Those are the people who you really should be feeling sorry for. Yeah. Like, coaches have guaranteed contracts. Like, it's, if the organization wants to move on from him and still pay him, that doesn't strike me as like some massive tragedy. But yet there's still in our society like the sanctity of the coach, and like every time a coach gets fired, it's an indication that like our society is in decline and people just don't respect coaches, and these darn players are out of control. Like, that's kind of like the subtext here. And no, like they felt someone else could do a better job. Like, you should, if you think that, you should move on from him just the same way that you would cut a player.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There's only 30 of these jobs, and it's an important one. And if you, at the end of the day, if you think you can, if you think you can get somebody better, it's the same thing you do with your roster.
Yeah. So
the same thing they do in front offices, for that matter.
Yeah. I mean, that's and so that's like, it's one thing if it's like, okay, he's an at-will employee and he's just not going to get paid as soon as he gets fired. Like, all right, then you could feel a little bit worse for the guy. But and Lloyd even said that himself in an interview. He's like, I'm not going to be upset. Like, Travis Schlenk was one of my best friends and he gave me a great opportunity. I'm not going to be bitter about it. And obviously, you need to say that if you want to get another job. But it's true.
Yeah.
Here at the Locked On Network, RockAuto.com is one of our favorite family businesses. They serve auto parts customers online, but they do it with that family touch. The chain store for auto parts, that model doesn't work anymore. They have different price tiers for professional mechanics and do-it-yourselfers. You go in, there aren't any parts out in the front. You go up to that desk, the guy goes into the computer system, they don't have your part, they say they can order it, you have to go back to the store again to get it. Why not just go to rockauto.com, enter your make and model, and shop for auto and body parts from hundreds of manufacturers. They've got everything from engine control modules and brake parts to tail lamps, motor oil, even new carpet. So go to rockauto.com right now, see all the parts available for your car or truck. Make sure you write Locked On in their How Did You Hear About Us box so they know that we sent you. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. rockauto.com.
What's up, sports fans? Matt Peck here, host of Locked On Bulls, and I want to talk to you really quickly about another excellent podcast. Huge Fan is a new SiriusXM original podcast where stars talk sports. Each week, join host LaChyna Robinson as she chats with your favorite celebs about childhood sports memories, game day rituals, the most heated rivalries, and more. And this new season features huge names like Anthony Ramos from In the Heights and Hamilton, Pat Carney from the Black Keys, Mel C, that's right, a.k.a. Sporty Spice from the Spice Girls, and even actress Michelle Williams talking about her love for our very own Chicago Bulls. Huge Fan is a fresh way to connect with your favorite artists, actors, and personalities about something we all understand, fandom. Huge Fan is now out on Pandora, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow the show or subscribe on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode.
Anything else? Any other thoughts on Atlanta? I mean, how are you feeling just about them going forward here now under Nate McMillan?
So I think they will probably end up with a better record the second half of the season because they'll be healthier. Yeah. I do think they have some really interesting decisions to make beyond this season. When you look at the John Collins situation and kind of the layout of their cap and how do they get a real backup point guard in there, and do they believe in the wing players they have, or do they need to bring in somebody else? So I think there's a lot of interesting decisions facing this team over the next 18 months. And, you know, once as a front office you make that coaching change, then your seat becomes hotter next. So, like, whether it's McMillan or somebody else, whoever they bring in after this has to work.
Yeah, and it seems like Nate McMillan will have a chance. It is very interesting to me that the Kirshner and Amick piece was like, oh man, like Lloyd Pierce was coaching too hard, like he's too much of a hard ass, and now, oh, but Trae Young loves the style of Nate McMillan.
Right, yeah.
Nate McMillan, I mean, maybe McMillan has turned over a new leaf a little bit, but to hear J. Michael tell it out of Indy, part of the reason they moved on from him was because he didn't really want to change his style and be a little bit more touchy-feely in terms of relating to his players. So maybe he's been different as the assistant. As you've noted before, the assistant is the one that everyone likes because he gets to play the good cop.
Yeah, exactly. And you see that over and over. And he's going to, you know, he's going to have to make these same hard decisions about, with, you know, especially when they get a little healthier, about which guys play and which guys don't. And, you know, is he going to play Rondo at all? Or is he going to play Bogdanović as the backup point guard? You know, what is he going to do with Cam Reddish? You know, those are all hard choices that, you know, now you're the bad cop. Onyeka Okongwu was another one. I think he played a little more yesterday, but he's still basically been in witness protection the whole time.
Yeah. I mean, how has he looked when he's been out there?
I blinked. I didn't. Like, I couldn't you even tell it. You. I've seen so few of his minutes that I couldn't even give you an evaluation, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, the only observation I've had is that he looks a little small out there for to be in an NBA center. But that's, there's still times you can get away with that, particularly on the second unit. All right, I think that's probably enough on the Atlanta situation. You wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago about the Utah Jazz. And what you said basically was, if this isn't a championship contender, I don't know what a championship contender looks like. They've lost a couple of games since then, but they still have by far the best record in the NBA. They got three fewer losses than any other team at the moment. So explain what you meant by that statement.
Just in terms of a dominating statistical profile, right? When you look at them and what they've done in this regular season, I mean, it's not just that they have a plus nine scoring margin, they have the best record in the league, and they won 19 out of 20 games. It's like their underlying stats are actually even more dominant when you look at parts of the game. Cleaning the glass does a great job of this. If you weed out the garbage time minutes, they're actually getting killed in garbage time minutes because they put in their last five players and those guys aren't
Jarrell Brantley, my guy, is just not doing his job.
he is not helping their point differential situation at all. When I wrote the article, they were like plus 12 in non-garbage time situation, which is like total dominance, right? That to me is a prima facie case for, I didn't go to law school, did I say that right?
Prima facie.
Okay, thank you. For a dominant contending team. That doesn't preordain that they're going to win, but it certainly puts them on the short list.
Yeah, they have won 1.5 fewer games than expected so far, and they have the number two offense and the number two defense. So to put that in perspective, I mean, any net rating over 10 is ridiculously like all-time good regular season. As of right now, plus 12.0 on cleaning the glass net rating. The number two team in the NBA is Milwaukee at plus 6.8.
Yeah.
And that would be a point differential consistent with a 67 win team over 82 games, which again, that's up there with some of the best regular season teams of all time. So yeah, I think what they're doing here in the regular season, statistically, absolutely impeccable. No arguments there whatsoever.
But...
Well, okay, so certainly any team that's doing this in the regular season, like you have to give some credence to the idea that they could win. So let me ask you this. Are they your favorites in the West right now? If looking ahead 2 months, do you think that you will be picking them to get out of the West? Would you pick them to get out of the West right now? I guess would be a better way to say that.
I would pick the field over them, but I would pick them over any other individual team.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's reasonable. Now, it's looking like almost certain that they're going to have home court advantage. I mean, they project to win six more games, even per 538, which is a little bit lower on them. And that's the Raptor, which puts in a lot of past performance as well and looks more at the individual players than what you've actually done so far this year. But they project to win between six and eight more games than anyone else in the West. It would take a bit of a collapse or one of these other teams going on a crazy run to take away home court advantage from them. Looks like they already have some fans there, and looks like, you know, with some of the vaccine news, maybe we'll see even more fans. They've got the altitude as well, so that, and they may also, although we'll talk more about the rest of the West in a second, they may also only have to face one of the LA teams.
Yeah, exactly. That would be pretty big for them if they stay at one, and the Clippers and Lakers stay in the 2-3 bracket, which, I mean, that's an interesting thing on its own. Like, when you get to the last week of the season, is one of these teams going to try to sandbag themselves down to four if it looks like they could end up behind Phoenix and avoid LA team in the second round?
The Phoenix Suns are currently second in the West, and fear not, we will talk about them momentarily. But LeBron James played a bunch of minutes last night. They lost to Phoenix, and now he is going to be taking this game off before the All-Star break. I think that's kind of just give him a little bit of extra time before he has to go to Atlanta. But I think there's a, and it could be, I think probably Kuzma and Gasol are going to be out as well. So they're kind of like, all right, you know, it's not that important that we win this, because I think they are starting to realize they would probably rather be in the four seed. And that would be a bit of a nightmare for Utah to still be number one seed, but still have to potentially play both of the LA teams. I don't think they make it through that gauntlet if they have to play both of them. If they have to play one of them, you know, I'd say it's probably, assuming everyone's at full strength, obviously, that's another consideration. But
yeah,
I would have them underdogs even with home court advantage against either of the LA teams. Wow. And but you don't feel that way.
I think they match up better against the Lakers than the Clippers.
I agree.
I guess, you know, maybe I'm overreacting to the last time they played the Clippers, but so the thing they don't really have is like that big guy at 3-4 who can match up one-on-one against Kawhi Leonard or LeBron James. But I almost feel like it's a bigger problem against Kawhi than it is against LeBron, because
I agree. Yeah.
Because Kawhi tends to like post up and use his body and get into people more. Like LeBron, it's easier to play him with Joe Ingles. Not that, I mean, LeBron's still going to get 30, 10, and 10 or whatever, but that the physicality of that matchup isn't as overwhelming as it is when you play against Kawhi. And the other thing with the Clippers is that they can play five smalls more easily than the Lakers can, and really spread things out and kind of take Gobert somewhat out of the equation. Like, one of the things Utah has to figure out in a Clipper series is who can they put Gobert on where he can still be a factor as a rim protector. Like, you know, do you just put him on Reggie Jackson and live with Reggie Jackson shooting threes?
Yeah. Or Reggie Jackson hits a lot of shots that spot up shooter now.
Yeah, yeah. So that's not a great one. Or, you know, it depends partly who else the Clippers put on the floor, I guess. But when it's George, Morris, Leonard, you know, those three across the front court positions, there's not a lot of great places to stick Gobert. Now, you could go zone too, I guess, but the Utah's backcourt is so small. Like, I just feel like Kawhi sees right over those two guys at the top. So that's a challenge too.
Yeah, that's interesting. By the way, just to clarify what you're saying about Kawhi versus LeBron, I mean, clearly LeBron is the superior physical specimen of Kawhi, although that's no slight on Kawhi. But I do agree with you that just in the normal course of operation, Kawhi uses his body more. He wants to get the mid-range, whereas LeBron, he wants to face up. You know, he's not really using his body. He doesn't want to shoot mid-range jumpers the way Kawhi does. He's more physical when he gets down in the post, but they don't do that much of that. Now, if they go with Anthony Davis at center, maybe that changes a little bit. But then still, you know, you've got Gobert close to the rim when LeBron is trying to post up, and the really dangerous stuff that LeBron is going to do is, you know, backing down some poor sap and just putting him in the goal. Whereas Kawhi, like, there's a number of things about the Clippers. You mentioned that game, like, oh, it's one game, you don't want to overrate it. But that fit into all of my priors, and there's a number of reasons to think that. Number one is that the Clippers are a great offense and they never get to the rim, right? So Rudy Gobert walling off the rim, that doesn't really hurt the Clippers as much as basically any other team. So that's one. And then number two is that Kawhi, they don't have anyone to really stop him from doing exactly what he wants to do, which is kind of get into the mid-range and shoot over you, which in the playoffs is difficult. And then the Clippers switching, I thought, you know, a good veteran team that's not going to make mistakes on switches, you know, this isn't some team on the second night, you know, the Charlotte Hornets on the second night of a back-to-back coming in and trying to switch in Salt Lake City. Like, this is the Clippers, so they're going to make Utah go one-on-one. And if it turns into a one-on-one game and a mid-range shooting game, because the Clippers did a good job of keeping the Jazz away from the rim, like, that's a contest that I really favor the Clippers in. They have better personnel in that kind of a game than the Jazz do.
Yeah, that's the most interesting part of it is, can, you know, are Mitchell and Conley and Clarkson between them, are they good enough to find a matchup and take advantage of it in a playoff game when there's not a kind of an easy mark sitting out there? Like, when it's one thing if you know, try to get Lou Williams on the switch when he's on the floor, but if the Clippers are playing, you know, Leonard, George, Morris, Beverly, and, you know, either Jackson or Batum, like, you know, who are you hunting? I mean, I guess, you know, that there are guys who are weaker defenders and not as good as Kawhi, certainly, but like, there's There's not that one guy where you're just like, you know, neon red flag, like, kick me, go after this guy.
Yeah, so I agree with you. I think they match up a little bit better with the Lakers. And obviously, Anthony Davis has to be Anthony Davis I still would favor the Lakers too, particularly because I think the Lakers do have that Anthony Davis at center in their pocket. I think, you know, Gobert is just about the best guy in the league to defend a lot of these guys, and probably Anthony Davis is in that. Even, you know, I thought Gobert, even though Jokic was great in that series, I thought Gobert did as good a job as anyone can do on Jokic, and Davis is probably not quite as dynamic an offensive threat as Jokic is, and LeBron really wants to get to the rim, and the Lakers just don't have the level of outside shooting that the Clippers have. So I think actually all of these series are between the LA teams or between Utah and the LA teams be much more defensive series than people think they're going to be.
I would agree with that. Yeah, the like the Clippers series against the Clippers, like it could turn more offensive if the Clippers end up playing small.
Yeah, that's a possibility with Morris at center. I mean, I think they're only going to probably do that the last 5 minutes of each half would be my guess. And Ty Lue does just generally default more to offense as well. And I also think they'll end up just not playing Zubats by the end of that series, minimizing Lou Williams' role. Mm-hmm. Lou Kennard might not even play at all, you know, kind of like now.
I was going to say, he's barely playing in the regular season games. Seems like Terrence Mann has kind of surpassed him.
Yeah, but Mann's another guy who's just, he's not going to be able to hold up in the playoffs just due to his lack of shooting.
Yep.
Like, there's just too many weaknesses, I think. So, yeah, you know, with home court advantage, should I rule out the fact that, or the idea that Donovan Mitchell and Mike Conley and Jordan Clarkson can do enough one-on-one and that the Jazz can hit enough threes off the dribble, because that's the Clippers have really taken away the Jazz catch and shoot 3-point game, which is what they're really deadly at. No, I wouldn't say that's impossible, but I would think that the Clippers would have the advantage there. What about the Phoenix Suns though, John?
Yeah, they're playing really well, and you know, we already did our entire ode to Chris Paul last week when we talked about our all-star picks and the impact he has on a team, but the rest of this team is interesting because they're all young and they're mostly pretty good. Like, you know, Booker was named as an all-star substitute reserve, which I think that was probably a decent call, as much as I love Mike Conley. You know, he has a pretty strong case for being the 13th best player in the West this year. DeAndre Ayton has really come along. I think defensively he's at least neutral now, whereas as a rookie, yes, he was not. Mikal Bridges has become a really good two-way player, like an all-defense caliber defender who also scores a fair amount and can shoot and space the floor. 42.6 from three, like he's good. Then they're
good finisher, runs the floor, can drive it and make decisions off of closeouts, and 102 defensive rating when Mikal Bridges is on the floor. That's pretty good.
Yeah, definitely. And then their bench is just pretty solid. Like, I think they're built very well for the NBA regular season.
Oh, I'm sorry. Actually, let me interrupt. I had that wrong. Actually, they are much better with them off the floor. They are 102 with them off the floor and 109 with them on the floor. Sorry about that. That actually does lead into a point I want to make later. But sorry to interrupt there, but we correct our errors on this show.
Yes. As I was saying, their bench is pretty good. Like, they go 12 deep with halfway decent players. And so I think they're built well for what this regular season is, where a lot of times you're going to have three guys out, or your best players are only going to be able to play 28 minutes because it's your fourth and five or whatever. So they're built for this regular season. Now, in a playoff situation, how much do I believe in this team? Yeah. I mean, certainly when you get in these, you know, against the LAs, against Utah, against Denver, even, I probably would not give them the advantage.
I think they could be decent against Denver. We'll see. We haven't seen Denver at full strength in months here, and they did have a really nice back-to-back wins against Chicago and Milwaukee. But yeah, that's interesting. You know, Chris Paul has usually been pretty good in the playoffs. He's pretty good in crunch time. And Booker also, I think, for a lot of teams, is going to be a really, really difficult playoff matchup with his size and ability to get into the mid-range. I mean, I think they are kind of built for the playoffs in that they have these two guys who, particularly if you don't have switchable defenders, like if you're just going to let Chris Paul go at you against a conventional pick and roll defense, I mean, unless you got Rudy Gobert back there, like he's going to carve that up, I think. You know, the Lakers don't really have anyone to guard Devin Booker, which is a problem. You know, he went off on them until he got ejected last night.
Yeah.
I think they match up very poorly against the Clippers. But I think they actually, now they just don't have as much talent against as the Lakers do. And I'm sure things will look different when Anthony Davis is out there at full strength with the Suns trying to go at him, particularly because he can switch on to Chris Paul and stop him no problem in a pick and roll if you need to do that. So, yeah, I mean, you look at them and they don't have quite the high end talent. And the other thing is that so much of their success right now is built on this crazy second unit that they have with Dario Saric at center. And I mean, I watched them last night and they were great and there's reasons they're succeeding. But I also am skeptical that can continue into a playoff format, that you're going to close with Dario Saric at center and you're going to beat people.
I completely agree with that. You know, and that's one of the differences between regular season and the playoffs, right? Is that your bench advantage just almost completely goes away most of the time. For teams that rely on a strong bench, like the advantage of that just gets eroded so strongly in the postseason. Yeah.
LeBron's playing 41 minutes now.
Conversely, the weakness of a crappy bench kind of goes away, you know, for, you know, these teams like the Lakers a little bit, or Boston, especially in the East, you know, that they'll probably punch above their regular season weight for the same reason.
Yeah, well, heard it here first. The Hawks are going to punch above their weight in the playoffs.
Did you say play in or playoffs?
Yeah, I still like the Hawks at full strength better than, you know, the Hornets or the Knicks.
I think they're better than the Knicks or the Bulls, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah, so, or the Bulls are in that mix too.
Yeah.
I mean, if you had to rank the West now in terms of the likelihood of winning the conference, assuming full health, what are your West power rankings?
Okay, so I'll go one Utah. I'll go 2A Clippers, 2B Lakers. You know, very, very close. Feels a little splitting hairs-ish there. I scratch my head a little as to who has the advantage when they play each other. But I do think your point about the Clippers matching up better against Utah after that fact is well taken. And then I think there's kind of a gap there, and you get to like Denver, Phoenix, maybe a fully healthy Portland.
Yeah. I would go Clippers one, and but so much of this too just depends on how the bracket shakes out, right? Like if the Clippers are two and the Lakers are four and the Jazz are one, Clippers looking a lot better, right? Like whichever team gets to only have to play one of the other two,
I think has the advantage without a doubt. Yeah. And it's going to be the same thing in the East.
Yeah, so I would slightly favor the Clippers over the Lakers. Just when they've matched up head to head, I thought over the last 2 years, I think the Clippers have just had the better of it. And you know, the Lakers again, like, don't have a ton of guys. You know, do you want to put Anthony Davis on Kawhi? That kind of takes him away from some of his help responsibilities. It's tough for him to get through a screen. It's also just hard to tell with the Lakers because they so rarely actually play their best lineup in the regular season.
Yeah. And, you know, for a couple of these teams, I think there's the realization as they go through this season that the thing that matters, that truly matters, isn't the season itself. I would certainly put the Lakers in that category. I would put Milwaukee in that category. I think the Clippers are probably mostly in that category, although they seem a little more focused on this regular season than the last one. So some of this stuff you don't totally know until you see them in that playoff environment. And the one thing you can say about the Lakers is we've seen them do it.
Have we? Did they play anyone last year? I realize that's contrarian. Like, they obviously were very good. They beat the teams in front of them pretty convincingly. But, I mean, what was the best team that they played in the playoffs last year? Like, Denver?
Yeah.
Miami was so injured by the end.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I would say they contributed heavily to making Houston look as bad as they did.
That's true. Absolutely. Although with Russell Westbrook, as compromised as he was, I think Houston was always going to struggle. And if you just, when you have 20 shots a game from a guy who's going to shoot 37%,
it's pretty hard to overcome that. You're kind of drawing dead on offense right there. Yeah.
But no, I am a big believer in the Lakers defense. I think they have the best playoff defense in the NBA, and they have the best playoff defensive player in the NBA in Anthony Davis. Apologies to Rudy Gobert, who's clearly the best regular season defensive player in the NBA. I think AD just has a little bit more versatility than Rudy Gobert does. So, I mean, that's a good starting point. And then LeBron James and Anthony Davis on offense is pretty good too. It's really more about some of the support guys. And yeah. I mean, like, you know, Montrezl Harrell, that's looking like a real bust of a signing, right? Like, this was when with AD out, like, he was supposed to shine. He starts, he plays 19 minutes with Gasol and AD and Kuzma out last night.
Yeah. That's definitely a red flag there. It's interesting. Like, he's been productive in his minutes, but just his playing style and how he fits in defensively. I mean, this was all the questions that people had when the signing happened. And how do you fit that in a playoff game? Like, you're not really going to play him and AD at the same time in the fourth quarter of a playoff game. So that's all. And then Schroeder, like, low key has not been great. And Danny Green was really good. Like, even though he wasn't necessarily, he wasn't flashy. He was streaky as a shooter, but just a
You got to guard him, though.
You had to guard him. Good defender, and he just never got in the way, which is kind of a low key skill. But like, he never took anything off the table.
Yeah. Well, and also the playoff version of Rajon Rondo, who was so awesome last year. Like, that player isn't on the roster anymore either. Like, that. Yeah. I mean, I think the way Rondo played last year in the playoffs, I think he gave them more than Schroeder is going to give them this year.
That's a good point. He was, because he wasn't that good in the regular season, and then the playoffs last year, he was really fantastic. And the Hawks might have studied the regular season a little harder before they signed him to that deal. But
yeah, but wasn't that good is one of the more charitable things that you've said on this program, actually.
And then, KCP too, man. Like, he started off the year like gangbusters, and he's kind of he never shoots anymore.
Yeah, and so I don't know, you know, Gasol is looking like, I mean, I think when they match up against Denver, Gasol will be critical, but other than that, how much is he really going to play as well? So we'll see. You know, we felt the same way about the Lakers last year, though they had a much better regular season in the end last year than they're on pace for right now. But let's see what happens when Anthony Davis comes back. I mean, that's really, they were looking great until Anthony Davis got hurt. So we're a month ago, we're like, yeah, these guys are the no-brainer championship favorites. And yeah, some of the support guys haven't looked as good, and LeBron's cooled off from three, which I think is important. You know, that's a really important part of his game right now. But yeah, let's see what happens when AD gets back. I'm not going to hit the panic button on those guys yet. The average protein bar is quite terrible. It tastes like one of those layers of sedimentary rock at the top of the Grand Canyon. Built Bar has solved that problem, though. They are now up to 18 amazing flavors, 6 new ones. Cherry Barcia, cookies and cream, caramel brownie, lemon almond cheesecake. That goes with the 12 original flavors like raspberry, German chocolate, peanut butter brownie, double chocolate, mint brownie. They taste so good because they're covered in 100% chocolate, and they're soft and easy to chew, but they are still great for the health conscious guy. You can lose or maintain weight while indulging in a delicious treat. Bars are low calorie, low sugar, high protein, high fiber, great for a keto diet. For example, their peanut butter bar, 19 grams of protein, 180 calories, 5 grams of sugar, just 5 grams of net carbs. And you can get a free cooler with purchase while supplies last. Go to builtbar.com and use the promo code LOCKDOWN, the name of this network. You'll get 20% off your next order. That's promo code LOCKDOWN for 20% off at builtbar.com.
David Harrison here, the Locked On Washington Football Team podcast, celebrating with you a 21-grain salute to a less boring sandwich thanks to Dave's Killer Bread. I don't know about you guys, but when I eat pizza, I eat it for the toppings, not the crust. And when I eat a sandwich, it's for what's inside the bread, not for the bread. But when I throw a sandwich on 21 whole grains and seeds, thin sliced bread from Dave's Killer Bread, it is the epitome of addition by subtraction. That thin sliced bread lets me focus on what's inside the sandwich, but also adds to the sandwich with killer taste, killer texture, killer nutrition, a subtle sweetness, and a seed coated crust. Dave's Killer Bread is is America's number one organic bread for a reason. It tastes so stinking good. Dave's Killer Bread is made with the highest quality organic and non-GMO ingredients and is power-packed with whole grains, fiber, and protein. Visit DavesKillerBread.com to learn more and look for Dave's Killer Bread in the bread aisle of your local grocery store.
But alas, it is time to hit the panic button on a team that we will rule out of the playoffs.
Oh, yes. Yes. Okay. All right. Minnesota Timberwolves.
But John, did you think we were going to do the Michelob Ultra Player of the Week?
Yes, I did. That's what I was hoping about.
It's coming, everyone.
Okay.
It will happen.
Okay.
But yes, the Minnesota Timberwolves, unfortunately, you ruled them out of the playoffs on January 20th. So they are no longer available. I waited until last week to review who we have ruled out. We have ruled out three of the same four teams, which is OKC, Cleveland, and Minnesota. I have already ruled out the Pistons. You have already ruled out Orlando. I went first last week. It is now your turn.
All right. I think we're going to go in a different direction here. We have a team that has lost 12 straight games, that has scored less than 100 points in five of their last 10, and just kind of looks like they're cooked. Let's select the Houston Rockets as my team that will not make the playoffs.
You're really a believer in Detroit with Dennis Smith at point guard.
I just think that getting into that play-in tournament in the East, like, I can't eliminate Detroit or Orlando yet because of that play-in in the East. But yeah, Houston.
Well, you actually already have eliminated.
Oh, I eliminated. They're the second. I did.
They are the second team that you eliminated.
Sorry. Apologies. I may have jumped the gun on them, but
there's no shortage of choices here, obviously. But yeah, I mean the Houston Rockets. Let's do a little wrap up here on their season. I mean, it started off. What did they win? Like 5-6 straight right after the Harden trade, and then obviously they basically haven't had Christian Wood since then, and that is seems to have totally torpedoed their season at this point. But I mean, they are a really bad basketball team right now, the Houston Rockets.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing is they're not getting a whole lot from Wall and Oladipo either. Wall got off to a really good start. I think he's really leveled off lately. And then
he's being asked to do way too much for this team.
And then Victor Oladipo just hasn't had that burst, hasn't shot well. I'd be a little concerned about that one, almost to the point where they dodged a bullet with him not taking that extension. So it's just not looking great. PJ Tucker, you know, all these teams talk about trading for PJ Tucker, but he is, I mean, offensively now, he is just a total zero. Like, there's just nothing there. 7 points per 100 possessions. Not even shooting the ball well, even though he only ever shoots completely wide ass open threes from the corner. Those are literally the only shots he ever takes, and he takes like two a game, and still not being accurate or productive. He can still guard, but I think the idea people have of him, you know, being a guy who can help a playoff team, that's not looking great. Daniel House, low-key, having a really bad year.
Yeah, he's had some injury issues as well. But, I mean, when your top two creators are John Wall and Victor Oladipo, and half your games, only one of them are playing because neither of them can play in back-to-back. So John Wall at least played in a back-to-back to try to quell the losing streak, which didn't work. I mean, Oladipo, he can't get to the rim anymore. And that's not good because he's basically shooting 30% on all shots that aren't right at the basket.
Yeah.
And he's taken 39% of his shots from downtown. He's under 30% from three, and he's got four dunks in a Rockets uniform, which is not where you want to be. So maybe it could look better when Christian Wood comes back for them, but the big question is just, are they going to sell guys off? I mean, to me, that seems like a no-brainer, but, you know, Eric Gordon, I mean, this is the time to move on him. He's actually the one guy who's having a decent season on this team.
Yeah, you got to get out from that contract right now. Yeah, even if you don't take any picks back, just to get off of that deal would be a win.
Yeah, Eric Gordon. Gordon is shooting 74% at the rim as a 32-year-old. That's pretty good, particularly on this team, which, because part of their problem right now is they have no size, but they also have no spacing.
Yes, it's a bad combination. They're a team full of 6'4 rim protectors.
Yeah, I mean, the other than Christian Wood, and even Ben McLemore can't hit a three this year. Like, what is their team three-point percentage? Let me look at this. It's got to be awful right now. It is, 33%, 30th in the NBA, and they are third in the NBA in three-point attempt rate. So they are... The math is, even that math doesn't work out eventually. Other than Christian Wood, I mean, I think you would try to move everything that's not tied down, including Oladipo. If he has any value left at all, which in my opinion, he really shouldn't.
Yeah.
But if there's anyone even remotely interested in him, I would move him. And then
good save by the Pacers, by the way.
Yeah. And also you can then try to, Did you say they should try to move him for Caris LeVert?
No. I said good save by the Pacers moving him for LeVert.
Oh, yeah. Because the Rockets
didn't have to do that. They could have just hung on to LeVert.
Yeah. I guess they just wanted a little more payroll flexibility next year. I understand if they're going to try and tank the next, in the 22 and 23 season when they have their pick, LeVert at 27 and 28, probably, he's just good enough to not let you do that. I mean, you've mentioned this before. They have this top four protected swap that's within among four teams that they should probably be trying to keep. And if Wood comes back, they might actually end up being just effective enough to knock them out of there. But that's...
Wood coming back takes them from losing by 15 to losing by 5. That would be like your best case scenario for the Rockets.
Yeah, maybe so. Is Tillman Fertitta, is he on board with just his whole rebuild? Tim McMahon did say on his podcast with Windhorse that they're in sell mode. Kelly Eco of The Athletic hasn't been as sanguine about that, but he also said if they keep losing that it probably would be sell mode. So I guess we'll talk as we get into talking about the trade deadline in the next couple of weeks here about what the value of these guys could be. But they clearly got to be in sell mode, and it's just, they got Christian Wood and they basically got nothing else for the future of this team right now.
That would be accurate.
So, who knows? Maybe they even at some point end up trying to trade Christian Wood because he's only under contract for 3 years. I guess they won't be able to extend him unless they renegotiate and extend. That's probably I don't know if you can renegotiate and extend for only a 3-year contract. I know you can extend it, but I think it might be 4 to be able to renegotiate and extend still. I don't know if they changed that in the last CBA. So they could be in an interesting situation with him a year from now where they can't extend him and he's making $13 million.
When you say you can't extend him because his money is too low compared to what he could get in the open market in 23. That's what you're
right.
saying.
He would be, he's a $25 million a year player and he's making 13. You can just start him at 120% of that. That's not enough. So good job going for the 3-year deal, by the way, for him instead of 4. We'll see how he plays. Obviously when he gets back, he might be a little over his head with 42% from 3. So I still have to rule a team out, and let's see here, got a few candidates. I wouldn't want to give away my strategy here though to you for future weeks. The Orlando Magic, they're still the heart's still beating there a little bit. I think it's got to be the Houston Rockets as well, just because like the team, like the Grizz, the Warriors, the Pels, I mean those teams are all better than like these really bad teams in the East. So I think it does have to be the Houston Rockets as well. Now, John, I wanted to, you've been watching a ton of G League.
Far too much.
The G League bubble. Sadly, I have not really been as focused in on that. But anyone in the G League bubble who's impressed? Obviously, there's plenty of two-way guys who are down, plenty of guys on assignments from their teams, but also unaffiliated players who might get signed at some point here. Who's stuck out to you as someone who is better than we think or might be able to help a team if they're unaffiliated? What do you say?
I would say there are three two-way players who have played pretty well as bigs down there. And one of them in particular stood out. So Mamadi Diakite, Wahua from the University of Virginia, Milwaukee two-way player, had a very good session down there for Lakeland. And the Bucks now just recently called him up. I mean, is he actually going to play for the Bucks? I think probably not. But he's also a little older than some of these other
really
guys.
He's really thin, right?
Yeah.
Isn't he really thin?
Yeah, undersized, but like very switchable, loves to play defense.
Switchable is interesting.
Yeah, so interesting to see what his exact role would be on an NBA team too, because I think, you know, some of these guys can get away with playing as undersized fives in the G League, and it's harder for them at the pro level. Moses Brown on a two-way for Oklahoma City, and he's still really young too, and he was good in the G League last year. Definitely an interesting guy as far as a five to watch. I think he could end up being the Thunder's backup five next year. He's been really good down there.
That's fascinating to me. I knew little about him other than he's just kind of very awkward and thin. I mean, he's huge, right? Isn't he like 7'1", 7'2", or something like that?
I think you have that right. I mean, he's definitely a traditional. Yeah, he's 7'1". Definitely a traditional five. But he's been really effective. And again, I do think it's easier for these guys to dominate in a G League game where they're the only big and where there's four perimeter guys and they always have a clean run and they can kind of do their thing inside and just play one-on-one against the other big. So there is a little of that, but he's 21. He was definitely raw coming out of UCLA. Was on a two-way with Portland last year and was good enough that I was a little surprised they didn't keep him. So very interested to see what he can become.
I wasn't really familiar with him at all, but they played him very, very little at the NBA level, I thought. And when they did, I saw about like a 50-second segment of him at like the end of a second half or second quarter when like everyone was in foul trouble. And I think they were like -8 in his minutes. He like, you know, I mean, some of the mistakes he made were critical. He like, you know, stepped on the baseline trying to inbound the ball and turned it over and, you know, just like fumbled a couple of passes out of bounds and he looked so awkward. I was like, I mean, I don't know anything about this guy, but this might have been the worst 50 seconds I've ever seen in like the first 50 seconds of watching a guy. So that's all I knew about him. I mean, I wasn't going to make that my entire judgment, but when they let him go, I was like, okay, that's not a huge surprise to me. You know better than I do apparently on him. So, who is the third as yet unnamed gentleman?
The 58th player in the draft, the guy I had pegged as a lottery pick, has been without a doubt the best player in the G League. That's Paul Reed of Delaware, Philadelphia's affiliate. The interesting thing with him is that even though his shot looks funky, he's actually made a decent number of threes, and then he's able to dribble drive from the 3-point line. Is long, runs the court well, rebounds, very active defender, high rates of stocks. So I think there's a lot there. He reminds you a little in the way he moves and plays of Marcus Camby. He's a little smaller than Camby, and his jump shot is less jacked up. But that's especially in a G League environment where everyone else on the court is smaller too. Like you almost feel like that's who you're watching. And I'm not saying that his future is anywhere on that level, but I do think he's a guy who has clear rotation potential at a minimum.
Wow, John, that is quite the resume you just laid out there. Probably enough to make him the Michelob Ultra Player of the Week.
Yes. The most exciting moment in the history of this podcast.
Well, it's only worth it if you enjoy it. John clearly enjoyed Paul Reed being the Ultra Player of the Week. 2.6 carbs, 95 calories. Joy creates success. Enjoyment isn't the end game. It is the whole game. Paul Reed clearly enjoyed his stint in the gubble.
2.6. Paul Reed, 26 points today to lead Delaware to a comeback win.
That's right. Yes. 10 points for every carb that is in Michelob Ultra. Are you happy because you win, or do you win because you are happy? For Michelob Ultra, Paul Reed, the Michelob Ultra Player of the Week. Well, football may be over, but the NBA, college basketball, and the NHL are in full swing. I like it better when football is over, personally. And BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet on all your sports action. In fact, BetOnline even covers awards, TV shows, and reality TV. You got real-time updated odds and props on almost anything that you can imagine. BetOnline has you covered for all the news, scores, and odds. It's the best way to place your bets, and it's free to sign up. Head to their website or use your mobile device to sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. That's pretty good. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts, and don't forget the promo code LOCKEDON to let them know that you came from us. And so obviously it's dominated at the G League, but how do you think that could translate eventually into him being an effective player at the NBA level, particularly for a team like Philly?
Yeah, he's a little interesting guy to slot in next to Embiid. I think he's probably better to play either next to a shooting five or as a small ball five when Embiid is off the floor, just because like his long-range shooting is the weakest part of his game. I think he can guard fours and be totally fine. I think he can handle the ball well enough. He runs the floor well, but just you want to maximize your space around Embiid, and he's probably not the best guy to do that, but he can do everything else on an NBA floor. And so that's where I would see him fitting in. And I'm really interested to see whether they're able to carve out a role for him there in this next year or two. And again, he's on a two-way there right now.
Do you have an NBA comp for him?
I don't know. He's a funny player. Like I said, I mean, a little bit Marcus Kidd, but it's not quite Marcus Kidd. Like, he kind of moves like him, but he's more perimeter than that.
Can I bounce one off you?
Yeah, sure.
Thaddeus Young.
Yeah, that might be a good one. That might be a good one. More wired to score and less to pass than Thaddeus Young is, for sure. But that's a good one.
Yeah, and he's got a little more bounce probably than Thaddeus Young. And I mean, Thaddeus Young is a wonderful individual defender. And Reed, to me, at least you can correct me if I'm wrong here, seems like more of an off-ball playmaker type than a guy who's going to switch on to some of the best guys on the other team and shut them down one-on-one. But also he could, you know, Thaddeus Young wasn't this guy when he was 22 either. So
yeah. And Thaddeus Young was much more athletic. I mean,
that is a little bit of a tough fit with Embiid.
Yeah.
So anybody else who stood out? I mean, you mentioned the bigs. Any either guys who are on assignment who look particularly good or any unaffiliated guys that might be worthy of
sure. So on the perimeter, I would say of the guys who belonged to teams that were down there, I would say Malachi Flynn from Toronto had a pretty good session down there. They called him back already, but he was pretty good. I think two guys from Santa Cruz are looking at call-ups or 10 days, either a two-way or a 10-day soon. Axel Toupon, who's kind of a 3-4, pretty athletic, pretty good defender, can handle the ball okay, has always struggled shooting, but he's shot it well enough down there, and he's otherwise been fairly dominant. Probably the best perimeter guy down there in these 2 weeks. I think Jeremy Lin's been pretty good. He seems to have most of his burst, and you know he just knows how to play, right? Like, he just has so much more experience than these guys. So I think he's a guy who you could look at getting a 10-day contract soon. Another guy people don't talk about much, Sheldon Mack, who played at Miami. He was Sheldon McClellan when he played at Miami and then legally changed his name.
Yeah, I liked him before he tore his Achilles.
Yeah. Like, pretty good scorer, pretty athletic. He's been good. And he's, you know, he's 28, I think. So he's, you know, a little long in the tooth for what teams tend to be looking for down there. But in terms of if you're a team that needs immediate help from a 10-day guy, I think he's got to be right at the top of your list. Like, he's definitely been, as far as shooting guards down there, like, I think he's pretty clearly been the best one.
Yeah, he's I always liked his defense. He's able to get out of it in transition and drive it. The three-point shot was always like a little iffy for him, if memory serves. I mean, he's been kind of off the radar for 2-3 years now after turning his Achilles for the Wizards. But you know, he's like a 6'3", 6'4", combo guard. I guess I shouldn't say combo guard, he's probably just a straight.
He's just a straight too. Like, he's just wired to score. Yeah.
What do you make of the impending news that two-way guys are now just basically going to be NBA players who don't get paid by NBA players and don't count against the luxury tax, where they're eligible for the playoffs and they also are not subject to this 50-game limit any longer?
I think it's something that the league felt like they had to put in to make sure that teams had the best chance possible to field a real roster in a playoff game, and that's where this comes from.
Yeah, or even just in games the rest of the year, but particularly given this crazy schedule some of these teams are facing, you had games canceled in the first half.
Exactly. These teams, you know, Memphis in particular, I think San Antonio is also going to have 40 games, if I recall correctly. So those teams, they're going to have multiple 4 and 5s. It's just an ugly schedule, and they're probably going to need to rest players on multiple occasions, and this just gives them a much better chance of being able to compete on a consistent basis. And then the other thing is, this takes away some of the late season roster shenanigans that you used to see, where teams would sign their 2A before the playoffs and cut somebody else, so that if it was like Yuta Watanabe, who's in Toronto and is actually part of their rotation even though he's a 2A, they would have had to sign him to a standard NBA contract and cut somebody in order to fit him into that 15 and have him eligible for playoff games. And they don't have to do that anymore.
Do you think that, I mean, I think clearly this is the right decision for the league. I laud it. But if you're an agent of a 2-way player right now, is this a good thing or a bad thing for you?
Yeah, it's not.
One of these guys who actually might want to be called up.
Yeah.
Or signed, would have normally been signed to an NBA contract.
Yeah, they're gonna miss out on some money, it seems like, because they're being paid as a 2-way the rest of the year rather than being paid on a standard NBA contract, which would get them a little more. I also think it maybe sets them up, though, a little better in the offseason, to where they can go in. Most of these guys will now go into the offseason as restricted free agents. And so they might be in a little better position to get a better deal from themselves, you know, something closer to what, like, you know, John Conchar got from Memphis last summer, where instead of being on a true minimum like Lugans Dort is, you're able to get, you know, the Conchar got what, 2.2, 2.3, and 2.4, right? So
yeah,
these guys will be in a little better position, I think, in the summer if they're not signed immediately. But on balance, if I'm an agent, I'm probably not super happy about it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we'll see. Like, these restricted free agency as a 2-way, I mean, that's just where your money goes to die, it seems like. Just ask Jordan McLaughlin about that.
For
or
sure.
Ty Wallace back in the day as well.
I think Daniel House was probably the one who did the best out of it.
Yeah.
3 years at like 3.5, right?
Well, but I think he had already come on to an NBA contract before that. Remember, like, they actually, his agent, I thought, did a great job of not signing the long-term Hinkie special and just saying, hey, just convert us and then I'll be a restricted free agent. But because they needed him for the playoffs in whatever it was, 2019.
Yeah.
So they actually signed him to a real contract.
But they converted him to the 1-year minimum. So it was the same net effect as if he had stayed on the 2-way.
Right. But so that actually worked out well for him. I do, you know, Lu Dort obviously would have got a better deal after the playoffs than he did before. So if these guys actually play in the playoffs and perform, you know, I think they will be in a decent situation. There's also just so much money out there this year as well. So maybe teams will just, there'll be a less of a stigma of like, oh, the guy was on a 2-way. So we can't, I mean, you can give him a restricted free agent offer sheet just like you can give anyone else. Just for whatever reason, teams just don't do that due to the stigma of him being on a 2-way, I guess. So
yeah, all that money will go to bad centers instead.
Yeah. And the other reason that you're probably better off getting a new contract in the offseason instead of signing like the Hinkie special now like Dort did is teams just have more flexibility, right? Like, some of these teams, they're up against the hard cap, or they just, you know, they don't have any exception money left to give you more than the minimum at all. And so that you can just, you know, you can get like something like Conchar where you're getting $2 million instead of you're getting, you know, 1.6 or whatever.
Yeah. The other guy to really watch with this is Garrison Matthews in Washington.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the other thing about it, too, is if the team isn't going to make the playoffs, then they would have had no reason to convert you anyway.
Right. Yeah.
It's probably the case for the Wiz. You know, if you're in the case like Lu Dort, where they needed him for the playoffs.
It was different. You convert Garrison Matthews to forestall him becoming a free agent. Yeah.
What did you write about for The Athletic this week before we go?
So I wrote about Lloyd Pierce's situation, obviously, and we talked about that earlier. And then I also wrote about the traffic jam in the East, where as of Monday, we had 7 teams tied in the loss column between 4th and 10th, and trying to make sense of that and who's going to rise and who's going to fall out of that group.
Yeah, so my prediction on that, I actually haven't had a chance to read that one yet. What was your conclusion?
Well, I think it's going to end up a little closer to the way we thought it would be at the start of the season. Like, I still think Boston, Miami, Toronto have the advantage there, and that, you know, as we talked about a little while ago, I think Chicago, maybe New York are going to fade from that a little bit. Charlotte, though, man, they're kind of interesting.
You worried about Indiana at all?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, their upcoming schedule is death, like these next 12 games. So they could fall back from the pack a little bit. And then it's easy to say, oh, we'll make up for it with our schedule later. But there's a psychology to that. And there's a trade deadline coming up. So that kind of stuff can get in the way sometimes. They're an interesting team these next couple weeks for sure.
Well, and it's LeVert probably, it doesn't seem like, I mean, he might play a game or two, it sounds like, before the trade deadline, but not much. I mean, they desperately need his creation. I mean, they just got nobody who can attack him, off the dribble him, on this team other than Brogdon at this point.
Yeah, him or Warren, one of them. I mean, getting Jeremy Lamb back has helped some, but he's been so bad on defense that he's kind of given it all back, and it's tough for them to keep him on the floor all game. So, yeah, they're an interesting one, because I think we all assume that, like, maybe they wouldn't be great, but surely they would make the playoffs in this conference, and now even that's looking a little dodgy.
No, it is. I mean, I think they may have to really, I mean, until they get some different personnel. I mean, the team that they have out there right now, I mean, I hope you're hard pressed to argue that they're any better than the Knicks or the Hornets or the Hawks or the Bulls or even the Wizards, the way they're playing right now. So, and it seems like Warren, I mean, this wasn't really publicized at the time, but that's actually a navicular fracture, that stress fracture that he had. And he's supposedly still in a walking boot. Like, he's not even doing any activity at all yet. So if he's not even doing any basketball activity, you have to imagine it's going to be at least, you know, end of April, maybe at the earliest for him.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that's, they need him a lot sooner than that.
You don't want to mess around with naviculars either. Like, you got it. You definitely want to be err on the side of careful with those.
Yeah. It's an area that has such little blood flow. That's why it takes so long. I mean, you know, there's a reason Joel Embiid missed 2 years in a row, with the navicular, though supposedly the first surgery was not well done. That was part of that.
And you have to be careful even when they come back, how you bring them back. I mean, that was one of the, we had that with Marc Gasol, and even when he came back that next season, I mean, we sat him out in the back-to-back the fourth game of the season, and we were managing his minutes very closely that whole first half of that season.
All right. Well, hopefully you will agree that this podcast was well done. We'll be off next week for the All-Star game, but we'll be back to talk trade deadline surely in 2 weeks. Till then.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.